House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is March 9th, 2009. First item on the agenda that I'm going to talk about is House Bill 2344, which is at the bottom of the page. We're going to carry that over till next Wednesday for a work session. I'm sorry, this Wednesday, 2 days from today, for a work session. Okay, and then I'm going to open a public hearing a little bit out of order on Senate Bill 403. Open a public hearing. Senator Bonamici. I'm sorry to elevate your position like that. Back to the House.
Senate Bill 403 allows beneficiaries to a wrongful death action to agree to distribution of damages rather than requiring distribution through intestate succession, declares an emergency, and is effective upon passage.
Thank you, Chair Barker.
I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is in northwest Portland and the northeast part of Washington County, and I want to thank you for hearing Senate Bill 403 today. This is a bill that I'm sponsoring, and I want to report that it passed unanimously from the Senate Judiciary Committee. When it was on the Senate floor, it received 28 votes with 2 excused, and it has no fiscal or revenue impact. This bill will affect the surviving families of Oregonians whose lives have been cut short by wrongful conduct. And what this does is it amends Chapter 30 in the ORS that describes how settlement is distributed in a wrongful death case. And what happens now is that for most categories of damages, the court can distribute the settlement, the proceeds, according to the wishes of all the beneficiaries if they agree. And if they don't agree, distribution is based on intestate succession, which means that they follow the law for inheritance of property for people who die without a will. But in the category of punitive damages, the court can only follow intestate succession, even if all the beneficiaries agree on a different way of distributing the proceeds. So this bill is to change that inconsistency, and it permits distribution according to the agreement of the beneficiaries, as long as they agree. It doesn't change the fact that 60% of punitive damages still go to the state, and it also does not change the requirement that the beneficiaries pay income tax on the distribution. It does mean a lot to families who have lost a loved one due to wrongful death, and I urge you to send it to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and thank you again for your consideration. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but I'll likely defer to Chuck Tomlin, who's sitting next to me.
Anybody have any questions for the good senator? Please, Chuck, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker. My name is Chuck Tomlin. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and I would first like to thank Senator Bonamici for grabbing onto this bill, sponsoring the bill, and helping shepherd it through her through the Judiciary Committee and on the floor. Her explanation really covered the bases. This is particularly important to a client of mine who is a family who we represent, who is an older woman. Not sure. It gets younger and younger every day, but she's in her late 70s and in ill health. And under intestate law, she would, by law, be required to take 100% of the proceeds, even though if she could devise an estate plan, clearly she would want to share those proceeds with the next generation. This would, under current law, results really in a triple taxation of these proceeds. The first is the 60% that goes to the state of Oregon. The second is the income tax that must be paid both federal and state on the proceeds themselves. And the third then would be the estate tax when these proceeds passed from one generation to the other. This is a means by which the Senate Bill 403 is a means by which the beneficiaries, by their unanimous agreement, can, in a sense, do estate planning at this stage. And don't forget, these are people whose relative, in this case, a parent and husband, has been wrongfully killed by the wrongful conduct of others. So it did not seem to raise any controversy on the Senate side. I'm hoping and assuming it will not raise any controversy here. It really is to change or correct an inconsistency in current Oregon law. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Who would have standing to complain? I mean, would a grandson be able to say, wait a minute, I don't like that going to grandma?
Well, a grandson in this particular case would not be an intestate beneficiary. So it's only the intestate beneficiaries. In this particular case, it would be the surviving spouse and the children of the next generation. And any one of them, if they objected to a distribution, they would have to fall back on current law, which is intestacy.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the mechanism by this, if you're in, and we were dealing with some with probate in our last hearing, much to the joy of all watchers and listeners, and so as I understand it, if somebody dies intestate without will, then their estate would go to probate. The way we'd know if there was consensus among beneficiaries is because they'd all be notified. How do we make sure, you know, just for our peace of mind, how do we make sure that if there is a dissenter, that dissenter will actually come to light and that we will not trigger consent unless there really is consent?
Well, in this instance, it's actually the other way around. It's not a matter of someone dissenting. Every beneficiary has to affirmatively sign a paper that assents to the agreement. But in general terms, it's up to the probate judge. Every wrongful death settlement or judgment has to be approved. The distribution has to be approved by the probate judge. And so the judge would conduct a hearing if that was necessary, or if all beneficiaries, in fact, had signed a piece of paper, then would issue an order accordingly.
And just to further clarify, Senator Bonamici again, this is the same way that other categories of damages are distributed. So this is just aligning the one category with the others. The other categories of proceeds are distributed according to the agreement of all the beneficiaries if they agree. So it's just making it consistent.
That's helpful. Thank you very much. I think it sounds like a good bill.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 403 and open a work session on Senate Bill 403. Representative Martin.
I move that we move Senate Bill 403 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Martin moves Senate Bill 403 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Hold the roll, please.
Representative Martin?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative
Holton?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Excused. Representative
Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Seeley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Representative Barton, would you carry for us, please?
Of course.
Thank you. Okay. Next item on the agenda is House Bill 2491. Open a public hearing.
House Bill 2491 expands the definition of intoxicants to include any substance that adversely affects a person's mental or physical faculties. This bill has a minimal expenditure and no revenue impact and is ready to be worked.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Hayes. And Roger Kravitz. Am I saying that wrong? Please go ahead and just identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Chuck Hayes, and I am the chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I am here today representing the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII and testifying in support of House Bill 2491. Under current Oregon statute, a driver can only be convicted of DUI if that person is under the influence of an intoxicating liquor, a controlled substance, an inhalant, or any combination of those three. The current statute does not include non-controlled drugs or over-the-counter medications or substances. In my written testimony to you, I have attached an attachment with that at the end of the written testimony that shows that of all 50 states in the country, all states have a statute that deals with drugs other than alcohol. 40 of those 50 states have either wording that is any drug or any substance, and some of those are combinations of those. There are 10 states, which includes Oregon, that is only a controlled substance. One of those states is New Hampshire. They just passed legislation to make it any drug, and that is now going to the Senate for a vote, passed the House. And another state also has legislation, and that is the state of Wyoming, also to go to any drug. So about 10 years ago, if you would have looked at the statutes throughout the country to determine where they stood on any drug or beyond non-controlled substances, there were only about 20 states that had such legislation or such law to include any drug or any substance. And about the past 10 years, we've seen more states coming on board with that type of wording or that type of legislation. And the reason for that is because we are starting to see an increased volume of drivers that are driving under the influence on our roadways that are using substances that go beyond non-controlled substances, non-controlled drugs. Since the inception of the Drug Recognition Expert Program here in Oregon in 1995, we're starting to see an increase as those as well. And I think all of us know and have heard and through the media and other sources that we're starting to see an increase of prescription medications by younger people and then also many over-the-counter non-controlled substances are being abused by young people as well. So those substances right now, if a driver is stopped on the highway for bad driving, there is some probable cause to believe that that person is under the influence, well then, if that is the only substance that is causing the impairment, well, you're going to hear testimony today that that person cannot be convicted because it does not fall within our definition of an intoxicant presently in the state of Oregon. In fact, we're going to give you some real-life cases of some things that have happened. One example that I have is when I was working for the Oregon State Police down in Albany, one of our troopers there stopped an individual who had consumed two bottles of NyQuil all at the same time and then attempted to drive. He actually almost caused a crash in downtown Albany, so the trooper responded to assist the Albany Police Department. The individual that was driving that car was so intoxicated that he could not stand up, and so field sobriety test actually had to be discontinued for his safety. He was arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants, had a 0.00 blood alcohol level. There was no alcohol involved. And so the toxicology later confirmed the presence of a non-controlled cough syrup. So because of that, then the case for DUI had to be dismissed. And so this man was actually charged with nothing. We found out later that he was addicted to drinking cough medicine, something that had happened while he was in the military, and had carried over with him after he got out of the military, and he admitted that he was drinking 2 to 3 bottles of cough medicine over the counter per day for his addiction. But because he was not charged nor convicted of DUI, he was not submitted to any treatment, any follow-up, or anything like that, because he, again, fell outside of the system. Another example, a trooper in Portland investigated a one-vehicle crash where the driver, a young driver, had consumed 2 bottles of Robitussin, another over-the-counter substance when abused at high levels can cause intoxicating results. He was charged with driving under the influence, but again, when the toxicology failed to reveal that a controlled substance or alcohol was on board, that case also was dismissed against this young man. And then a third case that I have, I worked this case while I was still working as well, is that a man in Portland who had gone on a trip left his antidepressants in his locker, a locker at the Portland airport. He missed about 5 days of taking his antidepressant. When he came back from his trip, then he took his 5 days' worth of antidepressants all at one time. He was driving a motorhome and proceeded south on Interstate 5, and by the time he got to Salem, he had the entire freeway backed up because no one could get around him because he was taking virtually 3 lanes of the freeway up. As a result, he was unable to do field sobriety tests. He was very impaired. He was charged with driving under the influence. There was no alcohol, again, involved. Toxicology confirmed the presence of 2 non-controlled antidepressants at high quantities. But yet again, he could not be convicted of driving under the influence. And these are just 3 examples. There are 3 examples where, fortunately, no one was killed, no one was seriously injured as a result of this. Statistics are showing us that More and more people now are driving under the influence of drugs. More and more young people, as we talked about, are experimenting with drugs and abusing drugs. And they are also learning that if they cannot get the drug of their choice, whether it be maybe something like methamphetamine or heroin or something like that, or even marijuana, that all you have to do is really go into the internet, and you can pull up the internet and you can learn about dextromethorphan, which is in a cough suppressant, cough medicine. There's just a tremendous list of things that they can use to become impaired, to get high on these substances. And unfortunately, many of these people then continue from a party or the setting that they're using the drug, and then it carries over to our highways. What I'd like to explain about House Bill 2491 and what it does. What it does do is by revising the definition to either include any drug or any substance, whichever way that we think proper to go, well, we can deal with these people that are using these impairing substances on our roadways, and they can actually be dealt with properly if it is a driving under the influence. And it also allows us to follow up with treatment and other types of intervention that may be needed for these people that are escaping that right now. It will also assist us in educating the public. In the state of Washington, in 1997, they passed their DUI statute to include any drug. As a result of that, Washington did a tremendous educational program through public service announcements and other type of things so that they could educate the public that you can become impaired on these other substances just as bad, as alcohol or some of the controlled substances that we have problems with. And then what House Bill 2491 will do is it will fix a loophole that we currently have in our law. And I'm going to tell you about this loophole, but it's most people know about it. Today, if a driver is under the influence, say, of a drug like methamphetamine, and so they are stopped by law enforcement, they're put through field sobriety tests, they're found to be under the influence, they can avoid conviction by simply refusing to give a urine test or a blood sample, and then later claiming that that substance that was causing the impairment was not actually methamphetamine, which it truly was, or some other drug, and claim that it was a cold remedy or it was an over-the-counter substance that is non-controlled. And without the evidence of the toxicology or other evidence maybe of finding the drug on that person, well, then the prosecutor's hands are tied. In the majority of these type of cases, that case has to be dismissed, and so no charges for driving under the influence. So that is a loophole that we have in our law. And our defense attorneys using that? Yes, they are. It's being used. What House Bill 2491 does not do, it does not advocate the non-use of prescription drugs or over-the-counter medications. We feel that it's just like alcohol or some of the current controlled drugs that we have out there today. If someone is prescribed Vicodin or Ambien or any of those type of prescription drugs that are controlled, well, then it's the same thing. It comes back to responsible use by the individual. When you go pick up your prescription at the pharmacist now, you have to read something, you have to check mark the box, you have to sign that says, yes, I was informed about the hazards of this drug. They give us written material. It also says it right on the prescription bottle that to use hazard when you're operating heavy machinery or a vehicle, and to be careful when you're doing those things. So, again, it comes back to impairment and also responsible use by the individual. Another thing that it does not require is that it doesn't require the Oregon State Police Crime Lab to do any additional testing. Right now, the Oregon State Police Crime Lab tests for a list of non-controlled substance that includes several of the over-the-counter problem medications that are out there. And so we're not asking the crime lab to do anything extra than what they're doing now. They report that information back to law enforcement. They report it to the prosecutors so that they also know whether or not they can proceed with this case. Because if the toxicology comes back, as I said, as a non-controlled substance, then the prosecutors are having to dismiss the case for DUI. And then another thing that it will not do is it is not going to increase the liability for those people that are dispensing non-controlled drugs or dispensing over-the-counter medications. Again, it comes back to just the same thing that we see today with pharmacists or doctors that are dispensing drugs like Valium or Ambien or Vicodin, any of those common drugs that can impair a person if they exceed or abuse or over-medicate themselves with those things. And it would be the same for the grocery store clerk or the grocery store owner, because people come in and buy alcohol off the shelf, but yet we're not seeing people coming back and trying to sue the owner of that establishment because they sold me beer, then I went out and drank too much beer and got arrested for DUI. That is just not happening. So I wanted to follow up on that just in case there was any questions, and I checked with Washington. As I said earlier, Washington's had their law since 1997. The Attorney General's office in Washington told me that since that law was enacted that includes any drug in their DUI statute, they do not have one record of any lawsuit ever being established or a successful lawsuit against a physician, against a pharmacist, or against a grocery store owner, someone like that that dispenses these products. So again, it comes back to being responsible use and awareness. And then the fourth thing, which I think is important for those of you who are maybe not familiar with this system, is that it would not change the current procedure as to how a person is arrested for DUI. Again, the officer has to establish probable cause. There's got to be something as far as the driving pattern that alerted them. And so these people are still stopped for causing a problem when they're operating a motor vehicle or a vehicle on the highway. The officer would still conduct field sobriety tests. If the person does not satisfactorily pass the field sobriety test, they're determined to be under the influence, then they are arrested. And then if the blood alcohol percentage from the breath test is not consistent with the degree of impairment, then a urine test or a blood test is requested. And if that is obtained, well, then it is sent to the laboratory where it is determined whether or not there was a controlled substance in this individual at the time of that arrest. And if it comes back with no controlled substance, as I said, then that case is going to be dismissed. So it's the exact same procedure that we are doing today. There's not going to be any difference because this is a post-arrest part of the investigation by the officer, and then we wait for that toxicology to come back before we can determine whether or not that person can actually go through the judicial process. So we do support this, and you're going to hear some other examples as well from testimony. But in summary, we want to express our sincere thanks to Representative Cameron and to Chair Barker for recognizing the seriousness of this problem, and also in attempts to try to get Oregon's our statutes caught up to what is happening in the rest of the United States. I do have a video, if the chair would like to see that, of an individual who is actually impaired on an over-the-counter type of substance that is available, should you want to see that if you have time. And we just urge your committee's support in passing this measure. Thank you.
And about how long is that?
Chair Barker, it's about 5 minutes.
Go ahead, Chief.
Thank you. Roger Craddock, Chief of Police, Coos Bay, Oregon. Today I'm representing the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. I come today to provide a couple more examples for you of persons that I have encountered and a person that my officers have encountered while driving under the influence of a non-controlled substance over the counter. The substance in this case was dextromethorphan, which is a cough suppressant. Commonly found in over 140 different products. The young man, and we'll just start with the first of our three encounters. In January of 1 year, troopers responded to a rollover accident, single vehicle rollover accident. The trooper, upon contacting him, found indications that he might be impaired, put him through field sobriety tests, and found that he was. The officer, in fact, trooper stated to me that he had slurred speech, seemed disoriented, and even drunk-like. He also found three empty bottles of Robitussin in the young man's vehicle. I conducted a drug influence evaluation on the young man. He admitted to drinking at least two of the bottles just prior to driving. He also stated that after admitting that, he knew that it was exceeding the recommended dosage. That was in January. In July of that year, another officer observed the person driving erratically and bouncing off the curb while driving down the road. He was stopped, subsequently arrested for driving under the influence. Again, his speech was slurred, appeared lethargic. He took a breath test. It was a 0-0, and I was called out to do another drug evaluation on this young man. This time, instead of drinking Robitussin, he consumed chlorocetin, which also contains the cough suppressant. When talking to him, he said, well, he used the more common name, DXM, for dextromethorphan. It's a safe and legal high. I admit it. It was reckless for me to drive in this condition. But it didn't end there. In October, we contacted him again. He was stopped by yet another officer who observed him driving 20 miles an hour under the posted speed limit. And he was weaving within his lane. Again, he was stopped, given field sobriety test, which he failed, and was arrested. Another drug recognition expert came out and did the evaluation. This time, he had taken a whole box of chlorocetin prior to driving. He told that DRE he learned about the effects of dextromethorphan in the seventh grade, and he started using and abusing it from the ninth grade on. He was arrested three times that year for driving under the influence. Not once was he charged with any crime, nor did he lose his license. You might ask me if that is just an anomaly. Is he just somebody out there that's the sole person that might be abusing that? According to a 2006 survey conducted by the National Safety on Drug and Health, an estimated 3 million individuals aged 12 to 25 have used non-prescription cough and cold medication to get high. Today I'm here before you and urging your support in representing the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association.
Mr.
Hayes. Yes. Mr. Chair.
I can imagine somebody's going to say, well, what if somebody just takes their cough medicine and we want to arrest them, would be the question. And these ones you're talking about seem to be using a huge amount of the medicine, way over recommended.
Chair Barker, the majority of the cases that we are running into, and then I think maybe someone from the Oregon State Police might be able to comment on this as well with the DREs, but we are seeing them using 2 to 3 to 4 bottles of NyQuil, Robitussin, all at one time, drinking it just as you would drink a beer or soda pop or something like that, and then also in a tablet form, because now the young people, teenagers, know that if I'm going to use something like chlorocetin, they're in a 24-pack, you use 24 of those, and they will tell you that that is the same effect as being under the influence of LSD or ecstasy. They get the same effects, but yet they know it's legal, and so they can do it and not get caught or not convicted of any crimes. So, yes, it is. We're talking about abuse. We're not talking about how a normal, responsible person would use this. It's not going to cause anywhere near the impairment that we're going to see unless it's abused.
Representative Westman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hayes, I appreciate those comments, but that's my concern, is we don't distinguish. I guess we're going to have other testimony. I can wait and hear that testimony. But what you've described in most of these cases, I have no problem with, and I would be glad to sign on that bill. But I don't see where we cover that guy. You know, to be honest with you, I remember in college, I was driving from a girlfriend's house to college in 2 hours, and I was coughing like heck, and I took a ball, and it did impair my... I knew what I was doing, but I don't think we want that on someone's record if it got stopped. I used bad judgment. I should have read the instructions. But one bottle, how does this protect that person?
Chair Barker and Representative, wasn't it? Well, again, what we're talking about is we're talking about the person that would be impaired. And so through field sobriety tests done by an officer, we're going to find that that person cannot pass field sobriety tests and shouldn't be behind the wheel of a car.
Are we talking about if I drank a bottle in 2 hours, would that alcohol level be high enough?
Chair Barker and Representative, wasn't it? It's not an alcohol level. It's just the impairing substance that's in there. So it's just like if I could give the analogy here about driving under the influence of alcohol. Sure, we have a 0.08 standard here in the state of Oregon, but yet we know that some people are going to be affected at 0.02 or 0.03 or 0.04 or 0.05. It all depends. So again, if that is impairing the individual to the point where they shouldn't be driving and they cannot perform field sobriety tests at roadside and they're showing signs of impairment, well, then that's where we feel that the action should be taken. Now, for most people, taking the prescribed dosage of what it says, one capsule every 4 hours, and if they're doing that correctly, they're not going to have any problem. But it's when people start using 2 to 3, 4 bottles of it or 24 capsules at one time, they're doing that purposely. They're trying to become impaired. They're wanting to be impaired. So it's not so much of a really of a mistake when you start seeing those kind of things happening.
Thank you.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe another take on the question is, what do we do about penalties here? Because it seems like maybe what we're getting at is there's a difference between the person who has thrown back a couple bottles to get a high and a person who just has an unanticipated reaction to a medication that was innocently taken. How do we differentiate between those two people? Because I think there is a difference there.
Chair Barker and Representative Garrett, I concur with that. I think, again, what it comes back to is trying to determine maybe from the arrest, maybe was there some intent involved possibly, or was it just if you're talking about a reaction or a bad reaction to, say, a prescription medication or to an over-the-counter substance, usually that's going to be able to be determined through the investigation by the police officer. And so I can tell you that some states have dealt with this. There are some states that actually have statutes in there that maybe cover that kind of thing, that if it's an adverse reaction. But again, that may be only be determined through the investigation and the follow-up with that individual.
Thank you. Further questions? Why don't you go ahead quickly, Sharon? I'm sorry, Representative Shields.
That's all right. I just wanted to make the comment that I think this hits on a very real problem. Oregon, I don't know if you mentioned this in your testimony, is number one in the country when it comes to prescription drug abuse. And I think this is one way to get at the problem. Another way to get at the problem is another bill that's moving through the process, which would create a prescription drug monitoring program. We're one of the only states in the western half of the country who doesn't have one.
Representative Shields, I concur with that because when we talk about the prescription medications, some of the cases that we are seeing that involve 3 or 4 or 5, 6 prescription medications, when the officer is doing the investigation, and I can tell you I investigated one on New Year's Eve night up right out here on Interstate 5 where a lady just drove right into the hedge of Interstate 5, and if she wouldn't have hit that hedge, she would have went across the freeway and no telling what could have happened. 6 prescription bottles in her purse. And 4 of those 6 were from 4 different doctors prescribing her the same medication. So it happens.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and show us that.
This is a young man who was actually apprehended. He had consumed 2 bottles of cough medicine.
You're going to tip your head back, you're going to close your eyes, and you're going to keep your eyes shut for 30 seconds. I want you to estimate 30 seconds. 30 seconds is up, I want you to say stop and look at me. Okay? I'll tell you when you begin.
This is a drug recognition expert who's doing the evaluation.
So let's go ahead and tip our head back and close our eyes. Stand up, please. Okay. Is there any part of that you didn't understand? Okay, let's try another test. Okay, repeat the term. And I want you to put your left foot on the line. You see the white line right here? Put your left foot on the line and put your right foot in front of your left foot, touching your heel to your toe. Just like this. Put your right foot in front of your left foot, touching your heel to your toe. Can you move your foot back? Wait a minute. We're not ready to go yet. Hold on, Anthony. Let me give you some instructions and demonstrate it for you before we begin. Okay? So once again, if you put your left foot on the line, back up just a little bit. There you go. So your left foot, now put your right foot in front of your left foot with your heel touching your toe. Anthony. Put your right foot in front of your left foot with your heel touching your toe. What's wrong? We have your phone. Over here. Put your right foot in front of your left foot on the line. On the line. Okay. Now, can you stand like that while I show you what I want you to do? Okay, so this is what I want you to do, okay? I'm going to have you take 9 steps forward on this white line. I'm going to have you turn, and I'm going to have you walk 9 steps back. On each step, I want you to touch your heel to your toe. I want you to count out loud. And once you start, I don't want you to stop the test. It's going to look something like this, okay? 1, 2, 3, and so on to 9. When you get to that 9th step, I simply want you to shuffle around like this, and then walk 9 steps back, counting each step, okay? Once again, I want heel to toe, touch on every step. Keep your hands down at your side. Once you start the test, I don't want you to stop until you get all the way back here, okay? And you'll be counting out each step. I want you to walk this direction. You ready? Begin.
Sure. What you're seeing here is that with dextromethorphan, and he admitted that he drank 2 bottles of this and then drove to, and then was going to try to drive home when he was apprehended. Luckily, he did not get in the car, but it gives a person an out-of-mind sense or an out-of-body sense. And so, as you could see, I mean, he was totally disoriented, and it just got worse and progressively worse to where they had to stop all of the tests. So, Representative Wissonette, this is what we're kind of talking about, is we're talking about people like that we encounter, that are not just showing where they're getting sleepy or something like that. This is something that's very, very serious.
And Mr. Hayes, on the when they do the test, maybe you're not the one to ask, I don't know if you know, would the test show the gross overuse of it? In other words, would there be some kind of quantify? So if I came in and said I just had 2 spoonfuls of that and it really affected me, I didn't realize it affected me, would the test show that I had 2 spoonfuls rather than 2 bottles? Is there some way to do that?
Chair Parker, actually not, but what you would be able to do, because you complete DRE does a complete evaluation, as Chief Craddock talked about, and so by doing that entire evaluation, you also have a chance to check their vital signs, and so basically with this drug and many of the other drugs similar to this, they cause the vital signs to be extremely high, and so to the point that it could cause death if it's left alone. So again, the more of the drug that they use, then the worse those vital signs will get. And so that's a great indicator to the arresting officer. And it's also credit to DREs who do these evaluations for maybe officers that are not drug recognition experts.
Okay, thank you. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You had me tell the video. Not because I don't think that guy committed a crime, because I think he did. But just because what I didn't see was the case that Representative Wisner is talking about. That's not the hard case. It's a great video, right? It's high comedy, but it doesn't help me at least resolve the crux of the question, which is, okay, we know we want to cover that, but by covering that, are we also covering, you know, we're covering X, yay, but does that also mean we're going to cover Y, nay? And so I don't know if we're working this today. I don't know what the status of the fiscal is, but that's an excellent question. Basically, the video just gave me time to think. I was with you at the beginning. It's like, oh, yeah, these, you know, people are always saying it took some cough medicine. It probably took a lot. We got to cover that. But I am actually now worried about also Representative Woods' question. The second, my second question or thought is we're dealing with a lot of really important DUII legislation, much of which, maybe almost all of which I support, at least at some level, most of which I support whole hog. And any input you can offer to us about priority ranking, sort of this, we have a challenging process, right, where we vote a bunch of stuff, yay or nay, thinking that it might die later, which absolves us from some responsibility in terms of coming to grips with what actually should become law and what shouldn't. And knowing, it's easy to say yes to every little, you know, tough on crime thing we've got, but is there a way to send priority signals so we don't leave all of that to the Ways and Means process? I know those are 2 very different thoughts. The second one really is the question. The other one is just a concern I've got.
And Representative Smith and Chair Barker, I think what we're, again, what we're talking about, we gave this example because this is the type of person that officers are encountering. Someone who is just using their prescribed dosages and taking the cold medicine, taking their NyQuil like they should be, unless they're mixing it with other drugs or mixing it with alcohol, we're not going to see that type of gross impairment. And those people are not being detected by police officers. They're not being arrested by police officers. And then if we're trying to, as you said, try to look at keeping the DUI and to, you know, fine-tune it, I do believe that we do need to fix our statute here in Oregon because, as I told you about the loophole, people are getting off because they can claim that it was that cough medicine. They can be exactly like that man there, and they're never going to be convicted of anything. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of not only looking at what we might need to do with our present statute, but we've got a loophole in it. We've got a hole in it. And I think that the situation is going to get worse because, as Representative Shields said, we are one of the top abusing drugs in the country for prescription medications, but we're also high, as you heard from Chief Craddock, about using some of these other innovative things. If you've heard about drugs like GHB, okay, that one, it took a while to get on the controlled substance list, but now there's another one out there called Salvia. And Salvia is being abused as well, and it's going to be a problem to us another year or two down the road. So we're just trying to fix a loophole in the country, I think, too, as this problem tends to increase over time.
Paul, Mr. Chair, just one.
Please.
Thanks. That is helpful. It leaves my second question unanswered and my first question mostly unanswered. Not out of disrespect, your testimony has been hugely valuable to me, but so we can talk about it offline, but the two specific questions I've got are, one, Representative Wisnant's question, how do we make sure that we're not covering, let's say, the person with a bum leg who doesn't really look good in the field sobriety test, looks askant, looks meanly at the police officer. Police officer said, you flunked the field sobriety test, I'm willing in good conscience to write that down. And the person, you know, takes a little bit, they test positive, and maybe that's never going to happen, we don't need to worry about it, and maybe even if it happens once or twice, it's still worth to do it because we've got way more people who are that guy risking killing people, and I get that. But talking about how do we, if there is a way to cover the easy case and not cover the easy case the other way, that would be helpful conversation afterwards. And second, priority signaling from the advisory council about which are our most important DOII bills so we know how best to spend the people's money would also be really valuable information, and I hope to be, you know, advocating for some way that we can come to grips with that so we're making sure we don't, you know, that we make those good decisions.
I would be glad to do that, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Next, I'll call Trooper EY and Bob Russell. Bob, are you going to speak against it?
Well, I'm not sure. If
okay.
I'm against
okay.
It.
Okay.
I have concerns about
it. You didn't check it. You didn't check the box. Okay. Either one of you, go ahead.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association, and I'd like to talk a little bit about House Bill 2491. First, the number one priority to the Oregon Trucking Association is highway safety, and we don't do anything that we think compromises that. And we don't believe that people should be operating vehicles on the highway that are impaired. We also recognize that truck drivers are held to a different standard, as they should be. If you're in a truck and you get a DUI, it's 0.04 instead of 0.08. If you're in your personal automobile and you get a DUII, you also have your license suspended, your commercial license suspended, so that you can't do in your private vehicle what you can't do in your truck. And truck drivers are not eligible for diversion. So when they get a DUI in either their personal car or their truck, their license is suspended for a year. They've lost their job, and they've got to go through rehabilitation down the road to get back into the profession. And that's all as it should be. However, when I look at this bill, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to tell truck drivers what not to do. And it's quite frankly, this is big enough to drive a truck through. And that causes me some concern if I can't explain to a truck driver what he shouldn't be doing. so that he can keep himself out of trouble. And it's back to the sort of the standards question. What is the standard? When do you reach that standard? And when do you know that you've reached that standard? I think that that's an important consideration, I hope, for the committee. You know, we do have drug recognition experts, a lot of them in Oregon, but not every officer is a drug recognition expert. When I look at the bill in Section 3, and it talks about field sobriety tests, it talks about detecting a probable impairment. I don't believe field sobriety tests are necessarily conclusive. So you've got a lot of ambiguity going on here, and that causes me some concern in terms of how it will impact truck drivers whose livelihood depends on their driver's license. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Stegler.
Thank you. Mr. Russell, approximately how many members of your association or would be driving a truck only in the state of Oregon and not crossing, not going interstate, not crossing state lines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Stegler, that's a good question. You know, in today's world, most trucking companies are operating in multiple states. Not all truck drivers operate in multiple states. So I don't know that I could tell you how many stay within the state and how many operate in multiple states.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
My point here is that you talk about not knowing what to tell your truckers mm-hmm. to do. And I would assume, I mean, we've got, if I remember, I don't have it memorized yet, the list that Mr. Hayes gave us, if I look, you've got California and Washington to the north and south of us that have that are in any drug state, and I'm assuming that these truckers aren't going to drive from Washington into Oregon and then cross into California and go, oh gosh, the standards are changing. I mean, I'm not trying to be facetious here, but your point is you don't know what standard to tell them. The standard when they cross into California or Washington is a lot more strict than what we've got in Oregon. So I guess err on the side of caution and know that you shouldn't be consuming anything that's going to impair your ability to drive that big rig.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stegler, you know, any drug, I think, is different than what is in this bill that's other substance. I think drugs are more specific. My observation also in a number of states, they have lists of drugs. They actually, so that you know what they are. Matter of fact, a couple of years ago, I went to a couple of meetings of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, and at that time, they were considering two different approaches. One approach was to list the substances so that we knew what they were, and the other approach was to go this way. It seems to me that the more specific that you are, the more you're informing people, but also, what does it mean to be impaired? With alcohol, you know what it is to be impaired. With this, it doesn't tell you exactly what it means other than you failed a field sobriety test, perhaps. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair. But the terminology that currently exists in statute is currently the same. I mean, with respect to impairment, this statute isn't changing that definitional standard in any way, shape, or form. The only changes have to do with what is considered an intoxicant. I mean, it currently talks about what can constitute impairment, and that's the standard. And you say you know what it is with alcohol. Well, there's a presumption that you're 0.08 or above, but
correct.
you can be under the influence at a lesser rate, and you have other controlled substances, inhalants, and you know there's not that same kind of rubric that we have for alcohol, but that doesn't mean you can't be charged with DUI.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stegler, I agree with you, but you know the standard is 0.08 for alcohol, and when we're talking controlled substances, I think there are lists of controlled substances so that you know what they are. And most folks, when you're talking controlled substance, whether it be an illegal drug or a prescription drug that's a controlled substance. Those are pretty clear. I mean, you would expect a normal person to understand that those things would impair your ability to drive a vehicle. But now we're talking about other substances, which is a much broader term. And that's my concern.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Trooper Ely. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Ey, last name is Iwai, and I'm a senior trooper employed with the Oregon State Police, and I've been with them for over 13 years. The Oregon State Police obviously remains neutral on this bill. However, I will provide some statistical data that is relevant to this House bill. This House bill expands the offense of driving while under the influence of intoxicants to include any substance that adversely affects a person's physical or mental faculties to a noticeable or perceptible degree. That is key when we're talking about this House bill. It also will redefine the word intoxicant. Currently, as Mr. Hayes had mentioned, that ORS 813010, the DUI statute, includes alcohol, controlled substances, inhalants, or any combination of thereof. That said, when an officer arrests a person for a DUI and the person has a blood alcohol content of less than 0.08% or more, or less than 0.08, and the officer can articulate drug impairment, then the protocol is for that officer to notify a drug recognition expert. Currently in Oregon, we have 193 certified drug recognition experts and 36 drug recognition expert instructors. The DRE who responds to investigate this DUI arrest follows a 12-step process, and I brought a copy of what we call the matrix. Every DRE has this process that we go through every time that we conduct a DRE investigation. It is systematic and standardized. The way that I do it is the same way that another DRE in Klamath Falls is going to do it, same way in Ontario. It's systematic and standardized, and that is the backbone for this program. We utilize 7 different drug categories. We do not talk about specific drugs. We put that into a drug category to identify drug impairment, which is then corroborated with the opinion of the DRE and toxicology. This program is validated through both laboratory and field tests going back to the early 80s and late 70s from LAPD. Oregon, as Mr. Hayes mentioned, started in 1995. 45 states currently are in conjunction with this DRE process. In addition, Canada and the District of Columbia, the IRS, 3 branches of the military, and several other countries are now participating in this fight against impaired driving. Truly, it is an international program. With current law, if a suspect is under the influence of a non-controlled substance to include prescription over-the-counter drugs, then by definition, DUI cannot be enforced. By having these cases not prosecuted, sends a message to the community that is controversial. We'll talk about that later in my testimony. From 2002 to 2007, the Oregon State Police Crime Lab has analyzed approximately 25,000 urine specimens as a result of a DUI investigation. For the same period, the top 13 non-controlled substances have accounted for 2,162 confirmed toxicology urine samples collected by subjects who arrested for a DUI. Here are some of the examples. Diphenhydramine, which is Benadryl or Sominex, have accounted for 342 positive toxicology results. Fluoxetine or Prozac has accounted for 224 positive toxicology urine screens, as well as Citalopram or Celexa and Acetylprolam Lexapro, which has accounted for 215 positive toxicology screens. Other drugs such as Effexor, Amitriptyline, Trazodone, Flexeril, Zoloft have accounted for 815 additional positive toxicology results that came back positive. This is a significant issue with DUI and its relationship with non-controlled substances. Last year, Oregon DREs performed 986 drug evaluations going through the 12-step process. Through to which 305 persons had non-controlled substances found in their urine following a tox screen. Of the 305 urine specimens, 41 had only non-controlled substances found in their system at the time of the evaluation. In 2007, Oregon DREs performed 1,247 drug evaluations, to which 255 had non-controlled substances found in their urine following a tox screen. Of the 255 urine specimens, 47 had only non-controlled substances in their system at the time of the evaluation. So as you can see, it's a very low majority. The DRE also indicates in his or her written report if the person is under the influence at the time of the evaluation. From 2006 to 2008, DREs have called 155 subjects not under the influence at the time of evaluation and called an additional 110 medical rule-outs. So every time the DRE does an evaluation, they're not always saying this person's under the influence, based upon the standards of the program. As an instructor in the impaired driving field, we are teaching our recruits to arrest based on impairment, not the anticipated blood alcohol content or admission of drug consumption, or for that matter, drugs found during the investigation. We simply arrest on impairment. If the impairment is present and the person is operating a vehicle at the time of the contact, then driving on the influence is the applicable crime. Remember, these arrests are generated from driving complaints by concerned motorists, traffic collision investigations, and traffic stops. Going back to the controversial message that we're sending is that these cases generate an arrest and they go through the judicial process and they're not prosecuted because in the actual statute, it doesn't fit in that statute, then somebody needs to be liable for this. And so we send a very incorrect message of, well, because it's not a controlled substance, it's a non-controlled substance, DUI can't apply. So then it leaves other agencies out there for liability. Chair Barker, members of the committee, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Cooper. Any questions? On Friday, there were a lot of legislators walking around that looked just like that guy.
Yeah, well,
thank you.
I didn't get invited.
Megan Pine.
Gail Meyer and Andrea Meyer, please.
Mr. Chair, can I ask you just one question before you leave?
Okay. Please.
And Megan kind of brings my attention to it. Senior Trooper, you talked about the idea of Prozac, okay? Our nation and our society is trying to deal with the mental health community more and more today. What do you do with the individual who is taking Prozac to try to have some normalcy in their life?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson. To address that question, I'm not really sure that I understand it, but I know that from the previous testimony from Mr. Hayes is that we arrest based on impairment, okay, as I've said before. If the person is taking the recommended dose of medication through their physician and they're within their therapeutic range, we should not see these signs and symptoms of impairment. It's when they take more or they're self-medicating themselves, which is a trained DRE, if they have their prescriptions on them at the time, we'll count to find out when that prescription was issued to that person and if they're supposed to take it three times a day, how many is left to see if they're self-medicating themselves. But again, it's only when they're outside their therapeutic range and they're taking them in high doses are we seeing this issue with impaired driving. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you.
Some guy makes a stupid decision.
Please go ahead and just identify yourself.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We can certainly empathize with the need to get impaired drivers off the road. I think the concerns raised by the committee to date with the vagueness of the new provision, subsection 4, is notable. I do note that in Chuck Hayes' submittal, on page 5, he has a reference to other state statutes. 26 states use the phrase any drug, and only 5 states are using the phrase any substance. And what I haven't heard from proponents as to really why they chose the phraseology any other substance as opposed to something more limiting might be any drug. But I do think that by choosing the more broad language, that I think that's probably the key source of a lot of the concerns raised today about the vagueness of this reach.
The problem, of course, language means everything, because when the trial court or the appellate courts look and tries to figure out what does the statute reach, it's going to look at the language and the language only. And if they can make sense out of the language, then they're going to go with it. And our language right now is awfully broad. Any other substance that can affect a faculty to a noticeable or a perceptible degree. They won't look behind those words to glean legislative intent unless they first determine that those words are not workable. A high jolt of coffee might fit within subsection 4. I know it's an extreme citation reference, but it's something that's possible. Or a congestion of the pop jolt or anything else. I was hearkening back to a time when I was driving after I had taken half an hour prior to that a new prescription for a steroidal nasal spray. I had to turn off the road because of heart palpitations. But, I mean, anything of that nature would technically fit within the phraseology of subsection 4. I think this language can be tightened up, and to be honest with the committee, I don't really know what to suggest right now. We'd be happy to come to the table and do anything we can to make it workable. I think section 4 right now, though, is too vague and too broad.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I too share the concerns expressed by Gail Meyer and OCDLA and some of this committee. I'm concerned a number of the examples given today were antidepressants. I'm worried that we're getting to folks who don't know the effect. I think when you talk about some of the drugs, if you take pain medicines, the Vicodin, it probably actually does say on the label, and even with some of the antidepressants, it might as well may cause drowsiness. I think we have some awareness, but I get very concerned. Not all the antidepressants, actually, and I think Wellbutrin may be on the list, and I was reading, has issues around drowsiness. But you get a whole class of people. What you're getting is folks who are not intending to get into their vehicle and cause any problems. When driving and drinking and driving, we all know you drink. For the most part, you shouldn't be getting in the car. It's drilled into us. Some people can handle a little alcohol and still drive, but basically the rule of thumb is you're drinking, you better start thinking about it. It's just not the same when you're taking antidepressants or other medicines to help a condition that you should know or foresee, and I'm very concerned about that effect. I'm one of those. My mother's one of those. We react sometimes the opposite or very differently than what the label says. I remember an allergy medicine years ago. It was supposed to jazz me up. It did quite the opposite. And so in those situations where people get, take the medicine, don't know or don't expect the consequences, I get very worried about a DUI being the way to deal with reckless driving and other activities on the road where they need to be better understanding the effect of their driving once they've taken that medicine. So I will, with that, be happy to answer any questions and hope we can try to narrow this, although with that said, I think still just narrowing it with drugs raises some concerns that people really know and understand when they get in their car.
Okay.
I'm Megan Cahay.
I'm the Vice President of Mental Health America. I'm happy to be testifying today in opposition of House Bill 2491. Mental Health America of Oregon is an advocacy organization for persons who use mental health services. And I want to say that it's very important that I point out that we are an advocacy organization for persons that use mental health services, because a lot of people that use mental health services use prescription medication, the psychotropic medication. And this bill has the potential for affecting a lot of persons in that category. I'm all for having bills that protect us from people that are abusing cough syrup. I think that's reasonable. I think it's very good to have strong bills against certain controlled substances, but the way this bill is written concerns me greatly that it would have unintended consequences for people that sometimes, well, let me just use my own self. You know, I take prescription psychotropic medication, psychiatric medication, for my own problems. I've done this for many years, and I take it responsibly. If I'm going to take sedating medication, I don't drive. And I plan my life so that when I need to take sedating medication, I'm going to be home and be going to bed. And if I have to take it unexpectedly, I don't drive. And that's the way most people are. But I can tell you that sometimes prescription psychiatric medication can have surprising and unintended effects. This is a fact of life for all of us, that, or most of us, that take psychiatric medication. Sometimes it acts differently than the way it normally acts. It can react to either hormones or to some other functions in the body. It can be very mystifying at times. This is just a fact of life, and it's unfortunate. And I tell you, it's a nuisance. But it does happen. And hopefully it never happens when I'm in a situation, or when one of my peers is in a situation where we have to drive, or where we're doing something where people are counting on us, and usually it does not, but it's possible. And I just want to point out that it is possible. But I want to say that people should not be punished for taking prescription psychiatric medication. People that are dealing with psychiatric illnesses or challenges should not be punished for dealing with psychiatric illnesses. We need support. And if we are taking psychiatric medications, we need to be supported for dealing with our illnesses and managing our illnesses. It is not easy. It is hard. And we need the support for doing that. Now, if we overdose, we end up in the hospital. That's what happens if we overdo it. I have done that. I ended up in the hospital. And it was part of my recovery to learn not to do that. And thank goodness I got through that, and I don't do that anymore. And now I'm in a position to help people learn another way, and I'm getting, well, that's part of my job today, is to help people to get through that. But also it's part of my job to protect people from bills that would punish them. So I'll wrap it up there, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. There'd be no intent to punish anybody for taking their medicine. The problem is if you're driving, and even if you have no intention, if you end up killing somebody else, that's a huge problem, or injuring somebody else or yourself. And so many times the medicines today will say in their ads,
which are way over there on TV, if I may editorialize for a second. But they'll say, don't drive or operate machinery until you know how you may react to it. And that's important, and that's what we're trying to get at. We don't want to catch somebody up in this that's innocent and had a cold medicine or two, but we don't want to see people that are using it to get high because they know they won't be convicted of drunk driving. And so that's the concern today.
Chair Barker, I think of that example that one of the previous proponents... Andrea Meyer, ACLU. One of the previous proponents testified about a gentleman who forgot his antidepressant medicines for 4 days and took it and ended up on the freeway driving probably recklessly and dangerously. But I am assuming that he was probably instructed never miss a dose, and if you miss a dose, make it up. And got there and tried to make it up. And guess what? It had unintended consequences, but he was probably just trying to treat his condition and had no intention. And maybe by taking one, he was perfectly fine and had no fatigue and been doing that for years. So I worry about those who are trying to just control their condition and take their medication, maybe not always appropriately, but certainly without knowledge that they're going to have a... Absolutely, Chair Barker, and I hope that the person is charged and that there are other abilities under reckless driving and assault and everything else under the code to go after someone who does cause damage, but...
Right. Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is really interesting bill to me. Apologies for that. The good cases are, I mean, the things, it seems like there's very little debate that we want to cover was that guy. Okay, and I'm even willing to say that guy if part of what he's got was prescription. The cases, it seems, that are challenging, at least to me, are one, if there's a mistaken flunking with a trace amount of substance. Okay, and maybe that never happens, or maybe it very rarely happens, and so data would be helpful to me on that one. If there's a mistakenly flunked field sobriety test, and then you have some cough syrup in your blood, and two, you know, sort of two wrongs make a right, or two rights make a wrong. The second is the mistaken but well-intended bad result from using an appropriate amount of an appropriate substance, or at least a well-intended amount of the appropriate substance. And I share a feeling with Chair Barker that even if we want a person taking substances, if it will impair their driving, we might not want them taking it then. At the same time, do we want that well-intended act to trigger all of the DUII provisions and penalties? And so those are, to me, the two. And trying to deal as granular as we can to the extent there's going to be conversations afterwards, because I at least am a vote to try to deal with that guy. And anyway, those are my... How do we manage those cases as best we can?
Chair Barker, Representative Smith, Andrea Meyer, I've forgotten your name.
Megan Cahay.
But I think she articulated a concern that's along the lines that you are speaking, which is people who are under psychiatric care dealing with psychiatric medications and are appropriately taking the medications and are stopped and have fatigue or other signs that an officer has some basis to suspect something's going on here. But it's not because of the medicine. The medicine's appropriately treating a condition, but the medicine shows up. And so I think that population should become particularly concerned about the unintended effects of if this drug is in their system. It will explain anything and everything as to why they're pulled over, and then they get a Dewey instead of I'm tired, and then you need to get home and stop driving rather than I'm arresting you for a Dewey. So I think we particularly need to be concerned when we are potentially unintendedly picking out vulnerable folks and people with disabilities and other health care issues.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess either for Gail or Andrea and committee members, there were times I remember the members in my office when I used to run a patrol office, they would be very, very frustrated because they would stop an individual that was loaded on a prescription drug. As a matter of fact, I can remember two different instances where one individuals had been arrested several different times, and the most that you could possibly do with them is reckless driving, and generally it would be reduced down to careless driving. That doesn't stop anything. Okay. I know that we're struggling, at least I'm struggling here even right now, with what, you know, Chuck Hayes was sharing with us, and it goes along with what Representative Garrett, I think, was trying to hit on the idea of describing the intentional behavior of wanting to get to that point with what we watched to all of a sudden, well, I didn't mean to get there, and all I had was a cup of NyQuil, and all of a sudden I get stopped and arrested for that, for the discretion of the DRE or for the officer. What? So here's my question now that I've said that. What do you think of if we were to identify maybe 3 or 5 of the most used prescription drugs as what Representative Shields was kind of addressing, because we are having a serious problem in our country with that, and apply that toward this?
Chair Barker and Representative Olson, thank you for the question. I'm struggling with all this too, because really what we're talking about is abusive quantities, consumption of an excessive amount of quantity that becomes abusive. And I don't know if we can sit and crunch and try and tighten up language that would get us all there. But I think that's what we're talking about. We don't want the occasional user of a cough suppressant who had an adverse reaction with some steroidal nasal spray getting them popped, when really what we're going after is the person who consumes 2 bottles of cough. And so I don't know if we can't get there by tightening up the language. I really honestly, I'm working on a lot of work groups right now, but I would be very willing to give this a try. Because there's a difference, but I think it's going to be hard. But the language is going to be very important, I think.
Thank you, Representative Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, Andrea, just to follow up, in the previous, the senior trooper gave us some testimony where there were 155 subjects that were evaluated that were not under the influence, and then there was another that they called an additional 110 as a medical rule out. So I think we're trying to set sometimes black and white standards here, but we do have people who are doing constant evaluation in their professional jobs, and there are many of those situations that the guy on the TV screen obviously wouldn't be a rule out, and yet somebody else maybe because of a medical condition or a similar situation to them. So I think we do have people that are we need to rely on sometimes to do their jobs as we move forward and look at how we can get there because of that demonstration we saw on the TV today.
Okay, Representative Shield. Oh, I'm
sorry,
go ahead.
Chair Barker and Representative Cameron, I think we all agree that the individual on the TV, but I do know this does impact some of the most law-abiding amongst us. There was, not too long ago, a Multnomah County District Attorney who got arrested for DWI, DUII, and the base element there was her antidepressant drugs. And so she's one of the most law-abiding people we know. So I do think that the language needs to be tight because everything can't...
If I may, Mr. Chair, she was arrested for it. Was she convicted?
I don't know.
And I think that would be the issue. Today the good representative from Albany today carried a bill on the House floor to help people that maybe were arrested and were not convicted for those things. But obviously if somebody's impaired and an officer makes that decision to pull them over, there are these situations that they have to go through to make sure that they... violating the law. So I just wanted to bring that point up. This isn't just because you're arrested doesn't mean you did something wrong.
Chair Parker, Representative Cameron, no, but it does mean that she did go through whatever screening mechanism would have happened at the station house, and she would have failed whatever test she was put through. So,
okay. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question could be for Gail or for counsel. I remembered that case, too, back in, I think, 2003, and I looked it up on the web. And it says in the article in Willamette Week something about arrested for driving while under the influence of prescription medications. Is that just shorthand that the reporter was using, or is there actually an offense called driving while under the influence of prescription medications?
There's not one. It would just have been a DUI.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And then just one other thing I'd say, too, when you talked about the mistake flunking, the trooper testified that the DRE is an objective test, not a subjective test. They have to go through those 12 things. But we all know humans are involved, so there could always be an error. Thank you very much. We have one more person to testify, Jody Vaughn.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jody Vaughn, and today I am representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association and also the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I've worked as a prosecutor since 1987 in five different counties during the course of my career. I'm currently a prosecutor working in the Deschutes County District Attorney's Office. I have worked prosecuting the drug impaired driver since 1995 when the legislation was enacted to include controlled substances and inhalants. What I would like to share with you is I've prepared written testimony, but I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the things that have been raised. Before 1995, officers would make arrests of people who were impaired by drugs that could not be detected, and we didn't know what they were. And basically what would happen is the case would not be charged. And in 1995, we had the ability then to take care of controlled substances, inhalants, and alcohol. And that helped us a great deal in holding people accountable. And when I talk about accountability, I mean not just arresting them and convicting them, but giving them the opportunity to go through the DUI diversion program, to give them the opportunity to go through treatment programs, because that is something that a person who is struggling with drug use needs to have. There's also incarceration, there's mandatory license suspensions, but part of this process involves the treatment and teaching the person how they can control their drug use in a way that doesn't put other members of our community at risk. Since 1987, I have read hundreds and hundreds of DUI arrests. I have never quit prosecuting a DUI driver, even though I've been rotated to other divisions of the DA's office. And what I'm sharing with you today is my experience since 1995. We are not talking about arresting more people. We are talking about holding those accountable that we have already arrested. The people that Senior Trooper EOI is talking about, they've already been arrested. They've gone through field sobriety tests with the arresting officer. They've gone through the DRE 12-step evaluation. And the urine comes back that shows the prosecutor that they don't have a drug on board that is consistent with our Dewey statute. These cases are being dismissed. What that means is that an impaired driver has been on the roadways of our communities. They have put property at risk. They have put persons at risk. They have put people's lives at risk. What I tell juries is that DUI is a crime where we actually get to intercept the person before they do something worse, before they kill, before they assault, before they damage. The only way to hold people accountable, and some people want a jury trial because they don't feel they're guilty, and that's fine, is to explain to them that we're not going to tolerate their kind of impairment on our freeways. One of the things that was raised during prior testimony is that these people they're not intending to go out and drive under the influence. That's true. And in fact, the statute right now doesn't require any mental state, meaning that the person doesn't have to wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to get intoxicated and go drive. This is a crime where your ability to make good judgments is impaired and you get behind the wheel of a car. So we can't say, well, you took your medication and you had an adverse effect and you didn't know better. The situation is, if you took your medication and you had an adverse effect and it's something that's not explainable and you get behind the wheel of a car, you're still putting members of our community at risk and property at risk. The person's going to be stopped by the police. They're probably going to be arrested. They're going to go through the field sobriety tests. They're going to go through the 12-step program. And the DRE is going to come back and say, this person is not affected to a noticeable, perceptible degree. Maybe they're feeling a little weird, but they look at the clinical indicators. They look at their pulse rate, their pupil size. They go through a whole analysis. And they'll come back sometimes and say, this person is not affected by this drug that they've been consuming. And as prosecutors, we listen very carefully to the drug recognition evaluator, because if that person does not support the prosecution, the jury will not support the prosecution. One of the options that was discussed earlier was whether or not we can't just file a reckless driving charge against a person if they're driving under the influence of an intoxicant that is not covered under our statute. And I would like to tell you that I've tried a lot of reckless driving cases. They're very difficult to prove. They're difficult to prove because we have to prove that the person recklessly drove a vehicle upon a highway in a manner that endangered the safety of persons or property. So we have to prove that the person is driving erratically. We have to prove that they maybe were going too fast or maybe they hit things. Sometimes impaired drivers don't do that. Sometimes they keep their vehicles within the lane, and they're fine until something happens, such as a ball comes bouncing out of the street, or another vehicle comes at them, or maybe there's a pedestrian or a bicyclist next to them. So sometimes we can't file reckless driving charges because we can't prove that the person acted in a reckless manner. What's important in this situation, and I appreciate the comments from the members, is that the job of law enforcement and the job of prosecution is not to convict everyone. Our job is to hold people accountable for driving under the influence. And many of these cases don't get filed if we don't have sufficient proof, because we do have a system of juries, and the juries will tell us, and we know through experience, what kind of cases they don't like. So if you have a person who passes a field sobriety test, like mostly, goes to the DRE evaluation, and they're not impaired, and even if they have a controlled substance in the urine, and we file that case at a jury trial request, the jury's going to come back and say not guilty. And DAs learn very quickly that it's a waste of time and money to spend a great deal of time in trial on cases that just don't have merit. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Shields. You're invisible today.
I feel that way sometimes. Is there a way that we could tighten that up to just focusing on prescription drugs and abusive amounts of other substances?
In terms of language?
Yeah.
I'm sure there are ways to tighten it up. My concern is this. There are some substances such as kava or salvia which would not be captured if you use the word drug. And so those are substances that, again, where people could be caught driving under the influence and not be held accountable. And so I suppose there's ways that you can do it.
Follow up. But I just want to make sure, because, again, I'm not a lawyer, but controlled substances refers to illegal drugs, not prescription drugs.
Prescription drugs can be controlled or not controlled. The Drug Enforcement Administration sets down a schedule of drugs. And so some drugs will appear, such as marijuana, heroin, methamphetamine, would be a controlled substance. Non-controlled substances would be common antidepressants that you've heard about today, trazodone, Prozac, Paxil. Those are non-controlled substances, but they are prescribed. So you should not have those in your possession except with a doctor's permission. So the problem is, what we have today is that people are under the influence of these drugs. Sometimes they get them through a prescription, sometimes they don't. But we can't prosecute them, and prosecution also means treatment, it means diversion, it means holding them accountable.
Thank you.
Okay, we need to be moving along.
Right.
Go ahead.
Just real quick, going back to the original question about why the group chose the term substance over drug, I'm assuming it's to capture what you just talked about, that there are some that wouldn't technically fall under that category.
That's my understanding of why the group chose that drug. I mean, chose that language, because drug would only include those things that are drugs. Kava and salvia, they're not. You know, they would be covered by any substance.
Okay. Representative Smith?
Thanks. I'll be quick. The rightfully impaired person is doing something dangerous. The question I have, and I'll ask it rhetorically for the Scriveners post-meeting, are the rightfully impaired people doing the same thing, subject to the same level of culpability as the person who downs a couple of bottles or steals some Prozac or, you know, drinks a 40 of St. Ives malt liquor? And if not, should the statute, if those people aren't doing the same thing, subject to the same level of culpability, should we differentiate between those, even if we want to deter and create some additional thing to deter the rightfully impaired person? And we can talk about that after, but I did want to put that on the record.
Thank you.
Can I respond, Chair?
Sure.
Barker? What I would like to say is that, and Representative Smith, what I'd like to say is that in my experience prosecuting these drug DUIs since 1995, we are not seeing people who have maybe taken two instead of one as a general rule. We are seeing people who are highly impaired, who are using drugs as a method of abuse, and they've lost their ability to make good judgment, and they're getting behind the wheel of a car. So when I look at police reports, I mean, every once in a while you'll get a situation where a police report will come in and you will say, this person looks highly intoxicated. The DRE will say, no, there's something wrong with this. And I remember in Josephine County that happened to me. The DRE said, I told the guy to go to the hospital. 5 days later, I got a letter from a family member. He had a brain tumor. So I'm looking at him, and he had alcohol in his system. I don't remember if he blew or not, but I was ready to file the charges. The DRE said, no, this guy's got a brain tumor, and in fact, that's what happened. So there are trained professionals who are trying to weed out those who are truly not guilty of the offense. And when I look at cases, I don't see Mrs. Smith, a 75-year-old grandmother who's taken an antidepressant, being arrested. That's not what's happening on the streets.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2491, and I'm going to instruct our council to try to come up with some language. There's obviously some confusion on this, and I think recognize that we need to tighten it up a bit, so we'll have another shot at it later. Open a work session on House Bill 2426.
House Bill 2426, we first heard on February 23rd. The original bill imposed a minimum fine and mandatory jail for a person convicted of DUI with a BAC of 0.2 or greater. We adopted the -1 amendment, which lowered the threshold to a 0.15% BAC and eliminated the mandatory jail. So it left with just the 0.15 and an increased fine, and this qualified Oregon then for the 410 grant funds as well. We have a minimal fiscal, we have no revenue, and it's ready to be worked.
And we've already adopted it.
We have adopted the dashboard.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee approve HB 2426 and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2426 to the floor with a due pass as amended. Is there any discussion, questions?
I'm sorry, I was a little bit distracted there, Mr. Chair. Could Council tell us what the amendments do again?
The original bill had the threshold at a 0.2% BAC, had required mandatory jail, and something else, I believe, and had the increased fine. What the amendment did was strike the mandatory jail, leave the increased fine, and lower the threshold to 0.15%, which qualified us for the grant funds but eliminated any fiscal associated with the mandatory jail sentence.
Okay, and so can I follow up? So the only punishment then is the mandatory fine of $2,500, is that
That's
right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Well, the only punishment that's associated with the increased BAC.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson? Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lucan?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, if I could just mention, I'm still thinking about that, and I just wanted to reserve the right to change my vote on the floor.
You always have that right. Thank you, Representative Shields. Motion carries. I'll carry that one. Next on the agenda is House Bill 2246. Open a work session.
House Bill 2246, first heard on February 16th, modifies the conditions under which a parent or guardian may give alcohol to a person under 21 years of age. You should have a -1 amendment in front of you, and this provided the exception for sacramental wine given or provided as part of a religious rite or service.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 into House Bill 2246.
Representative Wisnant moves the -1s into House Bill 2246. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Move it as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move committee send House Bill 2246 as amended with the -1 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2246 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lizette?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Smith, you want to carry that for us, please?
Sure.
Open a work session on House Bill 2171.
House Bill 2171, first heard on February 3rd, allows for prosecution for failure to report as a sex offender following a change of address in either the county in which the person previously reported or the county in which the person currently resides. If you'll recall, there was some discussion, I believe, between the proponents and perhaps it was Ms. Myers regarding the language that actually currently existed in the statute. You have a 2171-2 in front of you, and perhaps Ms. Beatty could speak about the differences. In
Ms. Beatty?
Or Renee Bryant.
Renee Bryant, yeah. No.
Renee Bryant?
No. Unless you. Quickly explain the dash two, what that does.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Renee Bryant. I'm legislative liaison for Oregon State Police. The dash two amendments seek to clearly explain that venue would lie in either the county from which the individual moves or the county to which they move by saying that there are two elements to the offense, one moving and then second failing to report. We believe this is consistent with case law that exists right now, so it's a clarification of the way that we've been reading the statute historically. And we work together with OCDLA, and I don't believe that there are any objections at this point. Any questions?
Thank you.
No, we don't. We do not have fiscals or revenues associated with this. I just received it Friday, so we can only adopt the dash two.
Mr. Chair, I move dash twos in the 2171.
Representative Wistam moves the dash twos in the House Bill 2171. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered. And then we cannot move that forward today. I have one more item. I want to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 403 to allow Representative Shields and Representative Krieger to vote on that if they'd like to. Representative Shields, how do you vote?
Aye.
And Representative
Thank
Krieger,
you,
how do you vote?
403. Aye.
Okay, thank you. Any further business to come before the committee today? Hearing none, meeting adjourned.